Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 16, King Chitraketu Meets the Lord, Text Number 55. Yena Prasupta Purusha Swapam Vedatmanas Tada Sukham Ja Nirgunam Brahma Tam Atmanam Adehi Mam. Yena Prasupta Purusha Swapam Veda Manastada Sukham Cha Nirgunam Brahma Tam Atmanam Adehi Mam. Yena Prasupta Purusha Svapam Vedatmanastada Sukham Cha Nirgunam Brahma Tamatmanam Avehimam Yena.
By whom?
The Supreme Brahman. Prasupta. Sleeping. Purusha. A man. Svapam. The subject of a dream. Veda knows. Atmanaha of himself. Tada at that time. Sukham happiness. Cha also. Nirgunam without contact with material environment. Brahma the Supreme Spirit. Tam him, Atmanam, the pervader, Avehi, just know, Mam, me. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Know me to be the Supreme Brahman, the all-pervading super soul, through whom the sleeping living entity can understand his dreaming condition and his happiness beyond the activities of the material senses. That is to say, I am the cause of the activities of the sleeping living being. Purport. When the living entity becomes free from false ego, he understands his superior position as the supreme soul, part and parcel of the pleasure potency of the Lord. Thus due to Brahman, even while sleeping, the living entity can enjoy. The Lord says, that Brahman, that Paramatma, and that Bhagavan are myself. I myself. This is noted by Srila Jiva Goswami in his Krama Sandarbha. So I'll just comment a little bit on these purports and read a few of them because they're rather short. Namo Om Vishnu Vidaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhute Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tiramane. Namaste, Saraswatam Deve, Gauravani Vicharne, Nirvisesa, Shunyavadi, Paskyadya De Sitarne. Here mentions freedom from false ego. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has explained that because of the false intelligence of the living entity, or covered intelligence, then the living entity acquires a false ego by which he misidentifies himself with his mind and senses for sense gratification. So this lusty intelligence, this is the cause of the living entity's entanglement in the material world. Lusty intelligence means that I want to control the material energy because I believe that by my controlling the material energy, therefore I'll be able to enjoy here. So as we explained yesterday, that the living entity is actually not controlling the material energy, that the living entity is in reality controlled by the material energy, because the material energy conditions the living entity his desires. Although the living entity may believe that his desires are independent, that he himself is the creator of his own desires. But in fact, the living entity supplied a set of desires that he misidentifies himself with in the material world and simply increases his material desire. And in spiritual life, the living entity identifies himself with the desires of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which is increases his spiritual desires. In any case, the living entity's desiring is not independent, but it depends upon his conception. So in the material conception of life, one misidentifies himself with the body and with the mind. So this is due to lusty intelligence. The lusty intelligence comes about by hearing, principally. Just like, for instance, when we hear so-called information, of course nowadays people hear things that are not really information. For instance, in America they have this type of music, it's called heavy metal music. You've heard of that? Heavy metal? So, I haven't really heard it, but I just heard some of it coming from the earphones of people who were passing through the airport. And it sounded like an intense volume of noise. And they also have this rap music where people are rapping. Mostly they're just rapping about how glorious they are. I'm the greatest and everyone should know it because I'm really the best and I do so many wonderful things and everything about me is wonderful. So people like that. So this is a type of information. But generally in modern civilization, glorification of sense gratification is the primary information that's distributed. Basically speaking, people are trained through the academic universities or schools where they're more or less conditioned into thinking that you are the body. Their basic instruction is that life has come about by chemicals and that has evolved up to yourself. And now you yourself are the pinnacle of the chemicals, but you're nothing but chemicals. And basically the duty of chemicals, the real occupation of chemicals, is simply to enjoy other chemicals. One chemical devours another chemical, and that way it enjoys. So the mission of human life, they explain, is simply to devour so many chemicals and be happy. So this has led to the conception that sense gratification is actually the philosophical correct position within the material world. That cintam aparayam cha pralayantam upashitya kama pabogam paramam etavam iti nischitya asya pasya shutarabhara kama krota parayana ihanti kama bogartha aneye narta sanchaya. People have educated into believing that the gratification of the senses is the prime duty of human life. That everything else is more or less illusory. This is the information that's being distributed. That you may search, you may strive for some kind of other type of realization or experience, but this is just dreaming. That reality is sense gratification, and when you wake up and you'll see that there's nothing but the senses and sense objects. And anything beyond that is simply a dream. Therefore, they believe that to gratify the senses unto the end of life, that's the prime duty of human civilization. That's why you have organization, that's why you have philosophy and training, to teach people how to gratify their senses. And therefore, even up to the point of death, because after death they believe that there is simply the void or there's nothing. And therefore there can be no measurement for their anxiety, because sense gratification means that the senses are impelling me to act in a certain way, and the more I act in that way, the more they impel me more. Material desire means I have some desire, and if I fulfill that desire, then the desire increases ever more. Therefore, there is no measurement to their anxiety, because these impulses coming from the senses and the mind are the cause of anxiety, hankering, and eventually lamentation. Hankering because we want so many things, and lamenting because we can't get every demand that the mind desires or senses desire. But people try the best they can. They have a big meal in the house, and they go outside, and they walk through the street, and they look into the windows of so many shops and see so many cakes, and immediately walk in and buy them and start eating them. Although there's no room left in the stomach, but somehow or another they find some room in their ear or someplace and fill it up every place you can find. Because that's the purpose of life. Because whatever the senses desire, then we fulfill them. And if you can't do that, then one must lament. So, hankering is suffering, and lamentation is suffering, and in between there's the satisfaction of gratifying the senses, which is the only pleasure they believe that there exists, and everything beyond that is illusion. Therefore, asha pasha shutara bada. Following such conclusions and lost to themselves, or as actually later on Krishna says something different, but asha pasha shutara bada, they're caught in a net. They're caught by the material energy, although they think this is freedom to gratify their senses as much as possible. Don't hold me back, you know, I want to gratify my senses. I feel like jumping off a bridge. This is my real desire in life, is to do that. I always was looking forward to that day. Don't hold me back and deny my primary desire in life. Oh yes, sure. Every person has, I heard especially in Holland, people think like that. That everyone has the right to gratify their senses as they want. That your method of gratifying your senses may be one way and mine may be different, but after all, real freedom means to allow people to do whatever they want. As long as hopefully it doesn't hurt too many other people. So if you want to take drugs, you want to jump off a bridge, whatever your mind and senses demand, your real goal in life is to surrender to them as much as possible until they destroy you, and that's it. Destroy your physical and mental body, and that's the end. And you've reached the goal, which is zero. You've become liberated. And in between, you've had a few moments of happiness by working hard to gratify your senses. But, so this is the conception, and it fills everyone's mind with this idea. Modern propaganda, modern education fills people's minds with these ideas, and therefore the mind becomes the repository of all kinds of lustful thinking. And naturally, because the mind is full of lusty desires, the senses, which are controlled by the mind, also becomes the repository of lust. And then Prabhupada writes, next, the intelligence becomes the capital of such lusty propensities. That is, the mind convinces the intelligence that this is really the goal of life. As we explained before, the job of intelligence, of human intelligence, is supposed to control the mind and senses according to religious principles so that gradually the consciousness of the living entity can be elevated. The living entity is covered by material consciousness, and therefore his goal in life is to purify himself by following regulated religious principles. That is, Krishna says, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence are covered. Indriyani Puranyahu, or Indriye, is that? Anyhow, the senses, mind, and intelligence are covered by their internal enemy in the form of lust. Avritam Gyana Etena, Gyani no Nityavarina, Kamarupena Kunteya, Dusprena Nalena Cha. These material desires, these material consciousness, these material coverings, it covers the soul. And therefore, the soul is inflicted by number two things. Avriyatmika Shakti and Prakshatmika Shakti. The illusory potency has two energies, one which covers the consciousness of the living entity, and therefore does not allow him to perceive things as they are. In the seminars, I recall this, the paradigm shift. Paradigm shift means that you have a certain vision of life, but when Maya covers one, the one's vision of life shifts from being the servant of God to being the servant of the body. So one is covered by this conception that I am a servant of the body and the senses, and pragyaptika shakti means that one is forced by the material energy to act in different ways. You're my servant, very good. Do this, do that, think like this, think like that. So this is called Maya, or the illusory potency. So Krishna gives us a program by which one can uncover the material consciousness and revive our spiritual consciousness. And he says in the very beginning, one has to curb this enemy of lust by regulating the senses and slay this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. So the senses, Maya tells us, don't regulate, just do whatever I say. But with intelligence, we're supposed to regulate the senses in the beginning. No, you can't eat more than your stomach can hold. That won't be very beneficial. No, you cannot have sex life indiscriminately with anything and everyone, anything that moves. No, you cannot smoke anything or take any kind of pill or drug. So Maya says that this is unfair. You're denying me the basic necessities of life. This is the purpose of life, and you're denying these things. So Maya has her philosophy, and religious principles have their philosophy, which are more based upon natural common sense and reasoning than actually the so-called reasoning that Maya gives us. In any case, in the beginning, one has to take to a process of dharma or religion, and by accepting dharma rather than demands of the senses and mind, religious regulated principles, and therefore control the mind and the senses. But if there's not enough information or dharma, if one can't understand things clearly, if one thinks, well, you know, I'm accepting religious principles because it's a nice mythology and my mother did it and her grandmother did it, so I'm supposed to do it too. But although it's just mythology, it has no real basis in reasoning, it's all based on superstition. So we should just do whatever we really feel like doing because that's really been proved scientifically. That it doesn't matter how much sex life you have, it's not going to affect your health or your mind or anything. It'll make you feel better. It's healthy to have that, to do that. It's unhealthy not to do that. So black is white and white is black, and whatever we say, that's correct. That the laws of nature, they change according to our feelings about things, the way we'd like them to be. So this philosophy means that when one has this philosophy, rather than real understanding of dharmic principles, like, for instance, Prabhupada said that if you're an ant, you should eat like an ant, and if you're an elephant, you should eat like an elephant, and if you're an ant and you try and eat like an elephant, then you'll have a lot of problems. But people don't believe this. You know, just eat as much as you can, and by our new scientific pill, you take it, and it'll dissolve everything that you eat. And then the side and the little label below in very small print, this medicine dissolves everything, including your stomach. But don't worry, we'll give you an artificial one from a baboon. Or maybe that of a horse, and then you can eat like a horse. So this is the modern approach. But dharma is supposed to direct intelligence, so gradually one gains mastery over the mind and senses, and therefore is freed from material desires, hankerings, and lamentation. But because there's not enough intelligence strengthened by dharmic activities, therefore the intelligence becomes the repository of lustful propensities, and therefore it agrees to acquire a false ego. Agrees to what's the sense of being aloof? Might as well embrace my mind and senses and really get into it. That's called false ego. I'm hovering in between, maybe I'm a soul or maybe I'm a body, because I don't have sufficient understanding of that fact that I'm a soul. Therefore, I choose to identify myself falsely with this body and mind for sense gratification. And therefore, one agrees voluntarily to become a servant of the senses and the mind. Just like we can see, for instance, when we're taking prasadam. So what is prasadam? Prasadam means that this has been offered to Krishna. Krishna has eaten this food. And therefore, when we eat this food, because it has a relationship to Krishna, we should naturally remember Krishna. And therefore be able to conquer over the demands of the senses and the mind. Because eating is a very strong impulse coming from the material senses. So when they talk so much philosophy, when it gets time to eat, immediately the mind says, get into it. Forget about this Krishna, this philosophy, this regulation. Just eat. It's prasadam, you can eat as much as you want. It's all spiritual, so just get into it. So then after a while, after one gets sick enough, no one starts wondering, wait a second, what's wrong with this philosophy? I thought it was supposed to be spiritual, and it seems to be acting a little bit like it's something material, too. So, therefore, one has to realize that spiritual doesn't mean against the laws of material nature. Spiritual means that it has some relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And anything that seems not to have relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which we accept simply for our sense gratification, therefore that's material. Therefore, eating too much, that act is not devotional service, it's sense gratification, eating more than required. But of course, because it has some relationship to Krishna, therefore it's not so as bad. And hopefully because it's related to Krishna, eventually the devotee will come to the platform of eating what's necessary. So the point is that the false ego, or lusty intelligence, which we already have, this idea within ourselves, that I can enjoy the material energy through the process of sense gratification, this has already been ingrained within us. On the other hand, one has to take shelter of the philosophy, at least, of regulating the senses by engaging them in devotional service. And regulating the senses means to understand clearly, by assimilating all different perspectives of the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, of what it means, what any activity means, how to see things as clearly as possible by assimilating as much as the philosophy as we can in every circumstance or situation. And the primary thing is utkramanti sitam vapi vunjana utkramantam vimurana pashanti pashanti jnana chakshusha. Generally, the foolish, they cannot understand how the living entity quits his body or what kind of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of material nature. But those whose eyes are trained with knowledge, they can see all this clearly. So basically speaking, we're trying to train our intelligence. Therefore, it's called Buddhi Yoga, to see things clearly in terms of Krishna consciousness. Not sentimentally, not dry philosophically, but a combination of seeing things in such a way is that we have both spiritual feelings and spiritual understanding. If we see things very analytically, I can dissect everything. I'm a knower of Shastra. I can analyze everyone's faults. And once in a while, I can see some good quality by my mercy in someone. So this type of mentality simply leads to more sense gratification, because it leads to a feeling of hopelessness, that after analyzing everything, we come up with the idea that there's no real feelings behind things, there's no real pleasure or pain, there's only the analyzation, which is ultimately leads to the fact that you are God. You are the supreme analyzer of everything. You can see everything clearly. And therefore, know how everything should actually go on. On the other hand, if one is completely overwhelmed by emotion, it's all feeling, it's all whatever it feels like, then one can mistake sense gratification as spiritual and spiritual for sense gratification. I cannot talk about this because it produces nice feelings and I'm not a good person, so I shouldn't really be happy, I should be miserable. This Krishna consciousness is too joyful, therefore I should only suffer because that's what I really deserve. So it produces all kinds of weird mentalities if one is actually simply on the emotional platform. One is left to his whimsical understanding of things to decide what is acceptable and what is unacceptable to feel and experience. Therefore, one has to properly guide his emotions with proper understanding, and therefore one will feel satisfied in devotional service. And one has to become free from the false ego. In other words, one should not choose to identify himself with the whims of the mind and senses. Instead, one should seek direction from the Supreme Lord and his guidance, especially from Shastra. One should see things in terms of Shastra and be guided by Guru and Sadhu to develop this vision, spiritual vision, so one can see things according to Shastra. Not just one or two instructions, but see the whole picture, assimilate the whole understanding of Shastra as much as possible in different circumstances, and ultimately to reach the conclusion, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, tad-buriyas-tad-atmanas-tam-nishtas-tad-parayanaha gajanyapunam-avritim-gyana-duta-kamashaha. When one's senses, mind, and intelligence and faith are all fixed in the Supreme, then one becomes fully cleansed of all misgivings through complete knowledge. And that proceeds straight on the path of self-realization. So the conclusion of Shastra is to engage everything. For the senses, the mind, the intelligence, one's faith, engage everything in Krishna's service, and therefore one becomes fully cleansed of all misgivings. But especially we're emphasizing here that one has to engage his intelligence. It is not that we're simply trying to become mechanical robots with a bunch of rules and regulations, and when I follow them, everyone claps, and if I don't, everyone says, look at that, they're a fallen rascal. It is not simply mechanically following some process. The idea is to develop our buddhi, or our spiritual vision of things, our spiritual feelings and emotions in relationship to things, to Krishna, and therefore in that way become satisfied in Krishna consciousness in whatever we're doing. Ultimately to remember Krishna and how to serve Krishna in different circumstances. It is not that we're simply trying to visualize Krishna in his form of Shyamasunda, but there's a whole other part of Krishna consciousness, which is to practically serve Krishna in all circumstances by understanding what is Krishna's desire in that circumstance that we do. That's called buddhi. And it's not simply one-sided, some analytical understanding. There's also an emotional involvement in the activity, a spiritually emotional involvement that produces Krishna, real satisfaction to Krishna, and therefore satisfaction to everyone else in relationship to Krishna. And therefore one can remain apart from the false ego, which forces one to misidentify oneself with the mind and senses. So the point is that it's up to our vision of things, either in Krishna consciousness, which will identify ourselves with Krishna, or in material consciousness, which will inspire us to acquire a false ego for sense gratification. No one can remain aloof for a long time. If I don't understand the process of Krishna consciousness, and if I don't get the emotional and intellectual satisfaction of Krishna consciousness, then I can hover on the mental platform for some time, but eventually I'll think, well, I've got to identify at least for some time with my mind and senses just to get some gratification. Because the senses and mind will constantly pull at one to gratify them, and therefore one may try and remain aloof from them for some time. But according to Bhagavad Gita, according to the Shastra, Srimad Bhagavatam, Yasyasti Bhaktir Bhagavata Kinshana, Savarganas Tatra Samasate Sara, Harava Bhaktasya, Mahaguto Guna, Manorate Nasati Davato Vahi. That one may remain on such a platform for some period of time, the mental platform, but unless he finds shelter in devotional service, in developing spiritual qualities, therefore, he's sure to be attracted again to fall into the material platform. Acquire false ego again, well, for a while I'll pretend I'm this body and see what I can, how I can enjoy the senses and mind. So, we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Yeah. That's when you first fall down from spiritual world, of course, no more question. Then how?
You'll probably get the well known answers to.
Then the man becomes contaminated. I read in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the creation that sometimes the living entity has pure consciousness even in the material world, and then it becomes contaminated at one point. Maybe you can explain something about the gradual steps from the spiritual world down.
Maybe you can explain something about your question. I don't know, what's the question?
How a living entity becomes covered over.
Well, the GBC, maybe they'll put out a paper about it this year. But in other words, you're asking about how the living entity fell from the spiritual world.
But then also, yeah, what happens? And these legs, they also say, don't immediately fall down into lungs, like they become first Lord Brahma, or before that, something else.
Well, in any case, whether if we're not talking about the origin, it's clear that the living entity has a tendency to enjoy, either spiritually or materially. So there was a paradigm shift in the living entity. He thought, well, I've been enjoying the spiritual world for so long, and therefore let's see what it would be like to be the Lord for a little while. So for a little while we're trying it out to see what it would be like to be the Lord. That's all. Probably gave the example, just like a rich man, he can eat anything. He's so wealthy he can eat. But sometimes he thinks, give me some peanuts, fried peanuts. Let's see what it tastes like. So in the spiritual world, we have unlimited enjoyment. But we decided, let's try this out for a while. Pretend that we are Radha and Krishna here and we'll enjoy. So we're trying it out. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. Therefore, when we get bored with this, then we can go back to the spiritual world. Either, if we're really sincere, we can go back and revive our relationship with Krishna. Or if we get bored with this type of enjoyment, we may merge into Brahman for a while. Why we do that? Well, that's our free will. Krishna has given us free will. We can go, by his arrangement, we can go anywhere we want to, by our desire, he makes the arrangements. So if we want to, we can go back to the spiritual world by his arrangement. If we want to, we can continue trying to enjoy here sense gratification, serve the senses and mind. Or give that up and refuse to go back to the spiritual world and remain in Brahman for a while. Well, it's a combined effort. Ultimately, it's just like you may have an instructor, just like the super soul. He gives information. So if you're sincere and you want that information, then Krishna will give it to you. If you pray to Krishna, then if you accept that he's there and that he can guide you, then you can take advantage of it. So as much as the individual accepts the group, then the group can help the individual. So it's a question of, as we said, explained yesterday, or as Prabhupada writes in the purport, it's a question of beginning with submission. So if the person's submissive and inquisitive and ready to render service, then he'll get a reciprocation of transcendental consciousness. Whereas Prabhupada writes at the end of the purport, when the student is only submissive and is ready to render service, then the reciprocation of knowledge and inquiries becomes perfect. So as much as one is submissive and inquisitive and ready to render service, to that extent he gets some benefit from the society. And if he's not, then hopefully he has a little tiny bit of sincerity to be submissive, inquisitive, and ready to render service, so that when he does that extent, he gets some kind of knowledge or realization of Krishna consciousness, which inspires him to increase his submissiveness, his service attitude, and his inquisitiveness. And if these things don't exist, either in the beginning, then he won't last very long in devotional service. No matter how good the group is, he has a different idea of what he's doing there. Yeah, I know that's how sincere we are. How much we're submissive, inquisitive, and ready to render service. That's our sincerity. And hopefully by following the process, then we'll become more sincere, more submissive, more inquisitive, and more disposed to render service. You exercise your spiritual muscle, it gets a little stronger, but that's eternal benefit. But the senses and mind will, as soon as one takes to the path of Krishna consciousness, the senses and mind will say, "You fool, why are you wasting your time? You know, you have a nice relationship with us, you may have had a little defect here and there, a little problem here and there, but we can work it out." And they'll constantly nag one. Until eventually one will think, this is too much for me, I might as well fall into Maya. And then Maya won't nag me so much. So as soon as one takes to the spiritual path, immediately Maya declares war on the living entity, because the living entity has declared war on Maya, and there's a battle. And sometimes the living entity succumbs to Maya again. But then Maya is not actually a very good shelter for the living entity. And so eventually he'll become discouraged from taking shelter again in Maya, and therefore go back to devotional service. But whatever he accomplished in devotional service, that has permanent benefit. Svapam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahatobaya. At least he'll get a human form of life so he can begin again the process of devotional service in some condition or some state. So we should encourage everyone, if they're actually sincere, because the idea is that there should be some standard who comes to the temple in the first place, who lives in the association of devotees. But we should be able to encourage people in their homes or outside to also practice devotional service, to come to the standard, at least some of them, to living in the temple. And then even if they're actually qualified in the beginning, but if they can't make it, then they get benefited. At least when they move out on the outside, they'll have learned something, which they'll probably apply in their outside life also. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Krishna can change it for you. He says, Tesham eva nukambharata mahama gyanajam tamaha nasham nyam yatma bhavashto gyanadi pena bhashata. Out of compassion for them, I dwelling within the heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness mound of ignorance. So Krishna, he eradicates. It says, Kechit kevala bhakta vasudeva parayana agam duvanti kartsnyena nidam niham eva abhaskaraha. that just like the sun dissipates all fog when it arises, so in the same way, when Krishna consciousness appears in the heart of the living entity, all sinful reactions are immediately dissipated. So if we're actually sincere, all these things will be eliminated. As far as when I change my karma or I become purified, then I get two heads instead of one and four arms or something like that. No, we have the same body, the same capacity, mostly the same capacity. We'll work in the same capacity, but we'll work in full consciousness of our spiritual identity, and the body will serve as an instrument for Krishna according to what he wants. But being free from karma doesn't mean that I suddenly get a different body and a different... No, it means that I have the same body, the same, but I'll have a different conception. I'll have a purified conception, purified mind, and therefore I'll be with Krishna in Krishna consciousness and agree to allow Krishna to work through the body and mind, utilize it for his instrument, for his purpose. And my consciousness will be on Krishna rather than on the body. My desires will be for Krishna rather than be over this body and mind. Yes. Who said that? Did he quote some source of information for that? I've never heard that before. Generally, it says that the living entity, the nitya siddhas, they come with Krishna. So there's no question of the nitya siddha becoming distracted. And the others who join Krishna in his leela are those who are practically... Those who are liberated, those who are sadhana siddhas or kripa siddhas, they join to perfect their leela with Krishna. So in that sense, they were already in the material world. There's no question of them falling into the material. They were already there. So according to that information, I don't know exactly, but nitya siddhas don't fall down. Especially they're coming here with Krishna for his purpose. There's no question of fall down. We don't find that, you know, one of the gopis left Krishna, went to live in the city and got a job there. In any case, whether Krishna comes in many different forms, none of those forms bloop. They're transcendental. And similarly, anyone who comes with Krishna, he must be coming with Krishna down to the material world, means that he was a nitya siddha. So where is there any question of his leaving Krishna? I've never seen it. You'll have to tell me where they... Yeah, I mean, otherwise it would be very dangerous, you know. I was having a nice, peaceful time in the spiritual world serving Krishna, but one day he asked me if I can come along with him. And I came along with him to the material world, and the next thing I knew, I had a job and I had a family. And I... Yeah. What's that? Yeah, maybe there's a misunderstanding. Anything else? Yeah, okay. The universe.
So then, if you don't hear, if you are pure, so you're not really there, then it's your sense
of
purity, and
you're not being pure. It'll have an effect. But here, the holy name means Krishna's name, his form, his quality, his pastimes, the loving exchanges. It means everything. So, if at the time of death you're chanting Hare Krishna, and you're in the spiritual world, and you'll remain there, even at the change of the body. But if one is not realizing in full the potency of the holy name, then there'll be some distraction coming from the material energy. And therefore, one will get his next birth according to a combination of both. He'll be given his next birth so he can continue on developing his Krishna consciousness. At the same time, according to one's situation at the time of death, one gets his next birth. So one has to be in the spiritual world to go back to the spiritual world at the time of death. Dhiryas tatranam uyate. That one who's dhira, then one who's actually sober, then he's not disturbed at the time of death. But if we're not completely absorbed in Krishna consciousness, there'll be some disturbance. Well, if you actually hear the holy name. But hearing the holy name doesn't mean, you know, just hearing Hare Krishna. It means remembering Krishna's form, his quality, his pastimes. Not only remembering them, but also being absorbed and experiencing them. You have to become completely Krishna conscious to go to Krishna. That's what it means. As far as any kind of Prabhupada mention about the time of death, he told, I think, Tama Krishna Maharaj, you go on trying to spread Krishna consciousness, and that if there's some lack at the time of death, then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu will make up for it. So that means that at the time of death, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu may come and give you some special mercy, so all these things will be realized. But we shouldn't wait for the time of death, saying, well, I just coast along at the time of death, we'll get some special mercy. It's like thinking, well, I'm going to study this very difficult course, I'm not going to pay too much attention to it, and right before the exam I'll get some special mercy and I'll know all the answers to the test. It's quite a gamble. Generally you should study seriously, and then at the time of the exam, then if you get some special mercy, so much the better. But in any case, you can't depend just on special mercy to pass the test. Can 16 rounds without offense. Little thing in there, without offense. So if you chant 16 rounds a day without offense for the rest of your life, you'll be in good shape at the time of death. Not that 16, snake, snake, ram, ram, day, 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 snake, snake, ram, ram, day, day, day. Hey, kitty, kitty, hey, kitty, kitty, hey, kitty, kitty. The time of death, when, hey, kitty, kitty, and one sees a cat, what happened? One has to chant Hare Krishna. But Hare Krishna, as we said, means that gradually one should realize Krishna's form and experience his qualities and remember his pastimes like that, and enter into the loving mood, loving exchanges of his devotees. So that's chanting the Hare Krishna mantra without offense. So Prabhupada, he had to make it as simple as possible, because otherwise we would think, well, that's too tough. Why, I'm not going to... So no one would have taken up the process at that time. So Prabhupada made it very simple, but that very simple appearance is actually rather involved, profound. So we shouldn't become discouraged. And I thought it was real easy, it was real cheap. Just go on chanting my schnick schnip and ram ram, and everything would be all right. As my mind drifts along in the past, lamenting about the past and hankering for the future. Even to merge in Brahman, he has to be more qualified than that. Yeah. Nor did he go back to Godhead by chanting his nam in nam vas. He just became free from being dragged away by the Yamadutas. And then after that, when he realized his mistake, then he went and he practiced chanting the holy names. And when he became fully purified, then he went back to Godhead. So Namavas chanting will not bring one back to the spiritual world, or offensive chanting. Anything else? Okay.
If you chant in fear or in you fall from the steps and you're Krishna, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Chanting without offense means to chant in full consciousness and full love of Krishna. Chanting in any other consciousness is not, that's Namavas, some covering. Is this half a question? Is it pertaining to the class or is it just? All right, go ahead. All right. Is something about Mathura or something? If one dies in Mathura, then doesn't matter if the residents Mathura, it doesn't matter who they are, they're still worshipable? Yeah, of course. Shastra is trying to give us a positive view on things. In other words, if one goes to a holy place and sees the residents there, it's not the time to start analyzing their faults. Because somehow or another, in a holy place, they'll get some benefit. As long as they're not completely sinful, then that has. Then living in the holy place is not recommended. Anyhow, it's trying to give you a whole, so when you go to the holy place, you don't waste your time criticizing people. Because they'll get some benefit from being in the holy place. Although they may go to hell for their sinful activities, but because they have some contact with the holy. As I said? Anyhow, so you should go and embrace them, offer your obeisances to them. You know, forget about everything else that says in Shastra and just take shelter of that verse, and then you'll be an Uttama Adhikari and you'll have nothing to worry about if you can do that. But other than that, generally other instructions will probably come into mind, like you shouldn't associate with people who are not, you know, following the path. They're called Sahajiyas, or worse than that, you know, they're not even practicing. Therefore, other instructions may come. So Krishna says everything, in one sense, a pure devotee, he sees everything in relationship to Krishna. Ista Deva Spuruti. He sees everything as Krishna's form. So Krishna is trying to give us some positive understanding of things. But that in itself is the vision of the Uttama Adhikari. And we're generally on the platform of Kanista Adhikari. So when you can see only with that vision, then you can claim yourself to be an Uttama Adhikari. But if you go there and see a leper engage in some sinful activity, and you go and offer obeisances and embrace him and ask if you can get the dust from his lotus feet, you know, that may be a little artificial. On the other hand, we should develop the proper attitude towards the residents of the Dham and not offend them unnecessarily. So there has to be some kind of assimilation of the philosophy in terms, so we can act in a practical way. Okay, thank you very much. Grandhara Srimad Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.